With us today for parts of Phantasms of Freedom is Eric the Blacksmith, and long-awaited, and glad that he's back. And Eric, how you doing?
Not bad. Hi, Al. Hi, Theo. Good to be back. Thanks for having me back on.
You weren't done yet. Okay, we're doing part six here. You're going to kind of bring us up to speed to where we've been. You know, I don't mean you have to sum it up, but we're going to not necessarily go into new territory. Maybe we will.
I'm thinking kind of, sort of. I have some new sources here. I do have my old standbys, but I'm kind of leaning, at least this time, more towards some different material.
All right. And, of course, we've got some feedback about Holograms of Liberty, which apparently seems to have struck a chord with some people, at least, as far as its impact. And that was nice to see, so thank you.
Oh, I'm glad. In fact, today I got home from work and I saw the wife go to the mailbox and she pulled out some packages, and one of them had the latest edition of the Hologram of Liberty, which was published, I think, in 2011. And I also got a book written by the same author, Boston Tea Party, a.k.a. Kenneth Royce, and it's called You and the Police. And a little byline underneath says, if you don't know your rights, you have none.
You know, I apologize. I keep calling it holograms. I want to make it plural, so excuse me for that. But Royce wrote that. I mean, how long ago was that written?
The first edition came out in 1997. And the most recent one, let me see. And he's got quite a bibliography. He's been quite prolific over the years. Let me see. Actually, no, May of 2012. So this is pretty recent.
If you wouldn't mind, let me just throw this out there, because I didn't get a chance to do this. You know, I was interviewed by two gentlemen from the UK on Thursday, and we talked a lot about this, and it went over pretty well. But there's something I wanted to throw in there, because what I talked to them about, I'm saying, listen, and I think we're all in agreement about this, that the way of the world is business. It's always about the money. That's it. I mean, forget all the starting of nations for any other reason except their new markets. I think we've covered that territory, and I think we're okay with that, all three of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, but this also applies to the end of Federalist Papers. Have you come across a name, Agrippa?
Yes. In fact, the Informer talked about Agrippa.
So I just want to read this because, I mean, I don't know how, I mean, this says it all. I just want to put this down as a baseline. I'm going to throw it to you, Eric, and, you know, Theo, indulge me. It says here, Agrippa, and this is, I'm quoting I-Man from, what was this called? The New History of America. All right, here we go. Agrippa then blows apart the piece of trash called the Constitution in the January 1st, 1788 letters of Agrippa, wherein he states, quote, it is shown from the example of the most commercial republic of antiquity, such a government can be only supported by power, and that commerce is the true bond of union for a free state. And then this is, I'm quoting I-Man. Agrippa is replete on commerce, and that's what a commonwealth, quote, corporate entity, republic that you want is still all about. I only state that because, of course, you come across Agrippa, and maybe we will even, you'll even take us down that road. But, I mean, that says it all. I mean, let's get over with the whole bit about, you know, huddled masses yearning to be free. Bullshit. It's about the money. And that's all it is. And that's what binds a corporation together such as the United States. And now I'll throw it to you, Eric, if you want to hit off that, fine. If not, you know, take us down the road you want to go.
Sure. Agrippa's actual name or birth name was James Winthrop. And, yes, number 11.
That's Winthrop?
Yes.
Oh.
Unrestricted power over commerce should not be given the national government. And that was his number 11. And scholars regard James Winthrop of Cambridge, Massachusetts, to be the Agrippa who contributed the series to the Massachusetts Gazette from November 23rd, 1787 to February 5th, 1788. And the PDF I have includes that this is a compilation of excerpts from Agrippa's letters of December 14th, 18th, 25th, and 28th of 1787 taken from Ford, Essays, pages 70 to 73, 76 to 77, and 79 to 81.
One quick question. I'm sorry, did I cut somebody off?
No, that's okay. Go ahead, Al.
Have you ever heard of the Federal Farmer?
Yes, I have. He's another individual that the informer referred to.
Right. And he writes, as the merchants and traders, they are our agents in almost all money transactions. Give activity to government and possess a considerable share of influence in it. So, I mean, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but, I mean, the point is, it's all about the money.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks, Elise, for that, and by all means, go ahead.
There was a farmer and planter. There was another anti-federalist just named a farmer. And, yes, there was a federal farmer. And he wrote several letters as well. In fact, 37 factions in the Constitution was one of them. And he talks about the Confederation was formed when great confidence was placed in the voluntary exertions of individuals and of the respective states and the framers of it to guard against usurpation, so limited, and check the powers that in many respects they are inadequate to the exigencies of the Union. We find, therefore, members of Congress urging alterations in the federal system almost as soon as it was adopted. It was early proposed to vest Congress with powers to levy and impose, to regulate trade, etc. But such was known to be the caution of the states in parting with power that the vestment, even of these, was proposed to be under several checks and limitations. Obviously, checks and limitations that the Federalists didn't want. I also received another book today. It's called Class Conflict, Slavery, and the United States Constitution, and it's authored by Stoughton Lind and forward by a Robin L. Einhorn. And the back of the back cover says, originally published in 1967, Class Conflict, Slavery, and the United States Constitution was among the first studies to identify the importance of slavery to the founding of the American Republic. Provocative and powerful, this book offers explanations for the movements and motivations that underpin the Revolution and the early Republic. First, Stoughton Lind analyzes what motivated farm tenants and artisans during the period of the American Revolution. We haven't really heard too much about artisans, have we?
No.
Second, he argues that slavery and a willingness to compromise with slavery were at the center of all political arrangements by the Patriot leadership, including the United States Constitution. Third, he maintains that the historiography of the U.S. has adopted the mistaken perspective of Thomas Jefferson, who held that Southern plantation owners were merely victimized agrarians. What do you think, Theo?
Oh, wait, the plantation owners were the victims?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a special hatred of Jefferson. I mean, you talk about a hypocrite and a half. You know,
he said all the right things.
Oh, yeah. His platitudes are plastered over all this country, and especially in D.C. And, I mean, if there's anybody who never abided by what he said, it was he. What an asshole. God almighty. But I tell you what, he's in a dirt room, man. It's so cool. You know?
Yeah, any guy who would have his own Bible, I would think, would be there.
Yeah, I think that's kind of in violation of what it says in Revelation about don't add a jot or tittle. Okay.
Right, or take it away therefrom.
Man, oh man, I'll tell you. Okay, yeah, what I always like too is all the crap about sometimes the tree of liberty has to be nourished with the blood of patriots. Okay, and when he was president, do you think he wanted to see that? I don't think so.
No, well, he should have said, as long as it's not my blood.
Yeah, as long as it's not my watch, yeah.
Right.
Hey, listen, I'm sorry to hit you with that, and of course it sounds like it was rehearsed, it wasn't, but man, you were right on top of that, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Sometimes you just get lucky, eh, big guy?
That's it, sometimes you're in the zone.
All right, so take us through the zone, if you will, with all the revelations you're going to come out with it today.
Okay, well, also, I just wanted to comment on a couple of things that I've noticed lately, and there's a local talk show that's on an FM station. It's pretty good. The guys are local talent. And they're talking about all the usual food groups that we've been hit with for the past few weeks, months. The whole thing with Snowden, this cover of this Boston Patsy on this portrait of this Patsy in Boston on the cover of the Rolling Stone. That's become a giant brouhaha. The Zimmerman case. And I called in to these guys and I said, look, I said, we're talking about a lot of fluff here. I heard recently that one of the bucket shops on Wall Street, the Wall Street Casino, manipulated energy markets west of the Mississippi to the tune of something like $1 billion. And I said, we're concentrating on a lot of fluff here, and basically we're getting a rug pulled out from underneath us, mm-hmm. and we're not even seeing it. We're not making anything anymore. We farmed out all our jobs, or at least a lot of them. And I asked this guy, I said, Lee Elsie's his name. He's actually a pretty good guy. I said, Lee, what the hell is the stock market doing at 15,000? I said, we're falling apart like a $2 shirt. And the stock market's, well, 14,000 plus, actually. Given another month and a half, it'll probably be up around 15 grand. He said, I don't know. I said, well, what about the speculators? Do you think they could have something to do with it?
Duh.
All this derivatives crap? You think that could have something to do with it? He says, you know, you might be onto something. I guess what I'm just trying to say is that a lot of people, you know, including the group at work, and I've been blessedly free recently of the killer Raghead for Christ emails, because whenever I get them, I either delete them or I hit these people with a barrage of information from The Informer and Montgomery and some of the stuff that we've talked about. And my absolute favorite was when I got an email about how Christian George Bush and his dad were.
I'm going to throw up.
I almost did. And then I took the liberty of sending the Washington Times article from 1989 about Reagan and Bush and their little activities
mm-hmm.
with underage gay male prostitutes and the like. Silence. Insert sound of crickets here.
You getting into the Franklin cover-up stuff? What's that?
That was part of it.
Yeah.
There was an article in the Washington Times in 1989 about how Reagan and Bush had these tours.
That's definitely related to the Franklin cover-up, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I certainly have no way of verifying whether what Kathy O'Brien said about the experiences she and her daughter had with these cretins. But I put it this way, I believe her more than I believe Bush and his gang.
I'll give you that, but I wouldn't trust her too much more than that.
No, a little bit more, but not much more than that.
Well, gentlemen, I keep near me this cover of Newsweek. Oh, my God. What was this from? Oh, this was too good. Oh, March 10th, 2003. $3.95 when Newsweek was. And the cover story is Bush and God. Why his God talk worries friends and foes. And the other story inside was how faith changed his life and shapes his presidency. Pardon me while I hurl a freaking squirrel.
I've done this a few times. I'm going to have to do it again. Dave McGowan does a good job relating this history in Program to Kill. G.W. Bush, I guess it was something like 50... executions that Christian governor signed off on when he was governor of Texas back before they gave him two rounds of the presidency. So 50, something like 50 executions. All right. Well, during that span, there was one woman, Carla Faye Tucker, who became a legitimate Christian by all appearances, by all fruit. A legitimate Christian in prison. She had a conversion experience, Carla Faye Tucker. She appealed to G.W. Bush to spare her life, as is, you know, who wouldn't do that? And,
I know, he said, oh.
Well, not only did he, you know, okay, it's his prerogative to go ahead with the execution, which he did, but he didn't just do that, he publicly mocked her. Alright.
Yes, I remember that.
Now, there was only one case, one and one only case of a guy on death of a prisoner on death row in Texas during G.W. Bush's watch. One case where G.W. Bush let the guy go. He pardoned him. And that case was
Lucas?
Of Henry Lee Lucas,
yes.
Who was a serial cannibal. He tortured his victims and totally unrepentant, and Dave McGowan gives a hell of a lot of evidence that shows that Henry Lee Lucas may have been involved in the CIA's Project Phoenix assassination program from the late 60s in Vietnam. It's horrifying. Now, okay, G.W. Bush would let a man like that go? Whoa. What's up with what's going on? It's what the mainstream brainwashed, dumbhead, evangelical Christians don't know. Many books have been written about what they don't know. It's shocking.
Well, we should have known when he screwed up the Texas Rangers and traded Sammy Sosa that he was an idiot. So anyway.
True enough.
Not making light of the whole situation, but I mean, look, do we not live in Alice in Wonderlandville? I mean, how crazier can it get? But that's the way it goes, you know. And we sit around, and there's no way in the world that we can ever decry the truth of Jeffers' statement: the cold passion for truth hunts in no pack, and it will always be that way. You'll have 99.5% of the people who just want to follow somebody and serve somebody and be told what to do, and there'll be that 0.5 people who think for themselves. And you know what? It's a losing proposition. You ain't going to build a business around it, and it will never be any different. And what are you going to do? But here we are. We do what we do because we know it's the right thing to do. And this whole bit about, well, someday somebody will discover what you do. I don't give a crap about that. I'll be dead. I don't give a Give me a break. Wake up now while you can. But I have, but there are really no solutions except, what we've always talked about. And the only way up is out. And at any rate. But, we'll get back to the topic here.
And it's got nothing to do with politics. Get your eyes off of that.
I heard a great expression that only in America could the word politics have such meaning. Poly meaning many, and tix meaning blood-sucking parasites.
Yeah.
Well, the two gentlemen from the UK asked me, when do you think it all went south? More or less, I'm generalizing. And I said, well, some people say we never had anything to begin with, and that's probably true. But I said, I think you guys will understand whether you agree or not, but really, we saw everything go south when the robber barons made their money and they started buying influence in the government until pretty much everybody in both houses were bought out. And they got their hands on the information outlets when it started with newspapers and went to radio and then finally TV. How do you beat that?
The education system.
Right. What education system?
Right. An author that I'm going to refer to did come out with an article 2006 entitled Dirty Secrets of the Temple, and how he talked about the Federal Reserve Act that gave the private banksters the power to transfer wealth from government to profiteers, with the public paying for it through taxes. And yes, he wrote it in 2006, and he explains how they did it, how the system works, and the horrific consequences. This is Michael Parenti, and he wrote a book called Democracy for the Few. I have a review of it in front of me by a Stephen Lendman, and he did a pretty decent job of it. He goes over the book chapter by chapter, and I am waiting for it to arrive. And this book was expensive. I looked for it on Amazon, and it's been published, I think, about 8 times. And there are copies going for $1,000, $100. I was able to get something like the 2001 paperback for a penny. And it was actually one of the few that was as cheap as it was. I don't know why it's so expensive, but apparently it's really created quite a stir. And he does talk about basically how it's a rigged game. And I like the term that you used some time ago, Al, dumpster fire.
I like that too. Got to be a Jersey thing.
No, I will. I have to admit, I stole that from Colin Cowherd from ESPN out of Bristol, Connecticut.
That's right, ESPN, not too far from my neck of the woods.
Yeah, I have to admit, I thought it was a great thing, a phrase, you know, and I know all the eggheads out there never listen to sports talk radio, but Cowherd said that, and I fell off my chair. And so I said, yeah, it's one of the best things I got to steal. But it's true. I mean, isn't it great? It's a great statement.
That is great. And he talks about, let me see if I could go through the chapters here. Before I do, I have to talk about the video, Theo, that you found that had the sovereign, quote, sovereign citizen, unquote, trying to go into the courtroom, and how it ended up after the razzle-dazzle, how one of the guys there pulled out his trusty little taser and let loose, and next thing I know, the camera was on the floor, and I believe I saw a twitching leg in the lower right corner.
Yeah, the title I gave it was Feds 1, Sovereign Citizens 0.
Zero, or nil, as the Brits would say. Yes. And I thought about that.
Well,
and I also...
Did you hear what that punk kid said? He said, excuse me, I'm a sovereign citizen, you're obstructing my freedom of movement. Then the next sentence, he's on the floor.
Moving all right. He has plenty of freal of movement when he has grand mal seizures.
Then it gets out into Alex Jones's news, you know.
What really
Alex
sucks?
Alex Jones, oh my gosh.
What sucks is the half right. I mean, he halfway gets it. I mean, yeah, there is the straw man, and yeah, the capital letters on the licenses and all of that. Yeah, we have the King's Highways that we're traveling on, and that's why we're... But he doesn't get that they make it up as they go along, and just because you know just because you've peeked behind the curtain doesn't mean they're going to change what's back there any day they want to.
I will take Jones seriously when he refers to the Informer and Montgomery. And he starts talking about that little nation state in Europe. Then I'll take Jones seriously, and then I'll believe that he's talking the real deal.
Are you both aware, I think you are, Theo, that apparently Jones had on one of Iman and Montgomery's most vociferous critic, a guy by the name of Larry?
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah, let me guess. He's one of the three classes of people that Jesus wished woe upon, right?
Well,
as in lawyer?
Yeah, no, I mean, it doesn't matter what whatever he is. But the thing is, and this is what's so telling, and this is what I said on that interview yesterday, Jones could have had Iman on and talked to him. He could have had Montgomery on and talked to him. But instead he found the person who he was happy with that, in his mind, could sufficiently debunk the other two, and had him on. So here's what I'm saying. By the fact that Jones had, quote, Larry on, that means Jones understands what's going on out there, and that's his stance. And if anybody ever thought that Jones isn't dirty, you're out of your mind. When I heard that, I said, that's perfect, because he knows the information's out there, and he's going to try to dump on it. You know what I'm saying?
It's shocking that there really are people who are still listening to Jones. It's unfathomable.
Well,
I can't stomach listening to him, and that to me is the smoking gun. Not only is he aware of Montgomery and the Informer and the real story, but by proxy, using this joker he had on, he's banging on the two guys in one fell swoop.
Yeah, but that tells you that he won't go where the truth is.
That's right. That, to me, that's the smoking gun, that Jones is as dirty as the day is long.
But you see, here's the other thing also, and we've spoken about this as well, and I don't think either one of you will have a problem with it, and if you do, by all means, I won't Jones you. You can say it, and I'll understand. But the problem with the Patriot idiots is that they are the same as the masses they make fun of. 99% of them need someone to follow. They're servile. 99% of them need to be told what to do. 99% of them need somebody to lionize and idolize. It's the same as the drooling masses they make fun of. It's just the same situation, the same dynamic, but with lesser numbers. It's the same thing, and it never ends. And that's why I had said to these guys as well, it's about human behavior, and human behavior doesn't change through the civilizations and the epochs. You'll always get most people that want to go ahead and just go with the flow because they can't stand to be out there. And you'll always have a small percentage that says, you know what, this stinks. And so you look at the Patriot idiots, and they're already screwed. You know what I mean? They're just following different types of Pied Pipers.
Which brings me to Albert J. Nock, who talked of this in the Memoirs of a Superfluous Man. Quote, according to my observations, mankind are among the most easily tameable and domesticable of all creatures in the animal world. They are readily reducible to submission, so readily conditionable, to coin a word, as to exhibit an almost incredibly enduring patience under restraint and oppression of the most flagrant character. So far are they from displaying any overweening love of freedom that they show a singular contentment with a condition of servitorship, often showing a curious canine pride in it, and again often simply unaware that they are existing in that condition, unquote. From Albert J. Nock, The Memoirs of a Superfluous Man.
Who also gave us, what is it, Enemy of the People.
Yep.
Also, if you give human beings food, they'll do simple tricks.
Hey, Andy, our buddy Andy introduced us to Albert Nock.
Yeah, that's
Andy,
right.
Andy got a kick out of that forum I sent you. I sent it to you and Herb, Al, and Andy. And Andy wrote back. He got a kick out of it. I found some guy who wrote, he posted a link to this show, and he was asking his, I guess, people he knew on this forum, hey, I stumbled onto this show, and they're saying that our Constitution has always been a fraud, and it's all a lie. He says, I don't know what to think. What is there any truth to it? And then the rest of the thread was a bunch of dumbheads who didn't even check out the show or
yeah, right. They attacked him.
And they just immediately start, attacking him and talking about reptilians. And it was like the guy wanted to be talked out of it.
Oh, without a doubt. That's what I wrote to you in an email, that it seemed like he wanted to be talked out of it.
Are correct.
But you know what the thing is that he was so pusillanimous, he couldn't even stand against them.
No.
You know, he went someplace to tell me that it isn't true, and who knows where he is right now. You know, I mean, he's probably got his head down some kind of hole.
I'm using those. Hole. Yeah, they were talking about a...
Maybe you wanted to see things from Jones's point of view.
There you go. But you know what? You can't war against this. And I really mean that this is hardwired into human behavior, and it's been like this forever. So what's the answer? Well, depends on how you want to go out of this world. You know what I mean? That's all I can say. There is no happy endings in a world that everybody wants a happy ending. And that's what I said to those two Brits. You know, you guys know. I mean, sometimes the news is just bad, okay? If you were 5 years old in 1938 Warsaw, do you think it would be a really good life for you? Sorry, that's just the way it goes. And guess what? We're in one of these epochs now. We have no idea what we're getting close to as far as a precipice, but we're drawing closer and closer. And the hubris and the ignorance in this country is so high. I mean, I kind of don't want to be around for it, and I think maybe I won't. But if I am, I want to be at a distance where I can at least laugh and nobody can hear me.
Yeah, I'd like to be in the same position.
What, like in Greenland?
You know what? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Actually, I told you, I want to apply for a fire lookout job in Greenland. But actually, Eric, I was thinking, too, it'd be really cool if I could get, like, a one-year job, like, out on one of the North Fork of Long Island, like, in a lighthouse, just for a year.
Oh, yeah.
So
well,
cool.
Race Rock Light was just, I believe it was, I don't know, under some kind of a partnership. I'm not exactly sure who took it over, but it's maybe, it's in the race off Long Island. And it's in some of the most turbulent water in the Northeast. and it's maybe a half a mile off Fisher's Island, and it's, you talk about a nice secluded spot. Oh, I wanted to mention that, talking about the police, I just wanted to mention in passing, this is one report that the Cato Institute actually got right, and it was entitled "The Alarming Rise of Paramilitarism in Police Forces Across the United States." I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty close to what it was. It came out, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, and it talked about the rising paramilitaristic mentality in police departments, whereas you always had that dividing line between the military and the police. You know, what's that old line about the military? What's the purpose of the military? To kill people and break things. What's the purpose of the police? At least ostensibly, is to serve and protect. And now we're seeing a blurring of that line.
It's,
I saw exercises. What's that, Theo?
It's not to fine and intimidate?
Well, I always thought this was the land of the free and the home of the brave. Turns out it's the land of the fee and the home of the slave.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to mention that, you know, in light of the taser email you sent about the sovereign citizen finding out just how sovereign he was.
What a dork, man. It's like the people who think if they fill out the right paperwork, they're going to be sovereign. Come
like my
on.
Friend at work. My friend at work, he got religion real fast after I laid some stuff on him. Hasn't touched it since.
If people want to do that, I want them to be successful. I think we all do. That's not the point.
Of course.
The point is, it's a changing game. And the day you walk in there, I won't do it now, but I threatened Theo to do it with you. Eric Goldberg from Georgia, who has been around the show for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Following one particular situation where a guy worked for Federal Express and would not file taxes, he went the whole nine yards. Even to the point where, you know, in federal court, he was given a couple of points, you know, for style, and they threw his ass in jail. I mean, is it really worth it? I mean, I don't want to pay the taxes. I mean, who are you kidding me? None of us want to. None of us can explain why some go free, but most don't. And even if you go free, if they catch up with you or just feel like doing it, they will. And I mean, for the young people out there, do you really want to do that? I mean, I understand why, but you're not being a hero. I mean, when you're in jail, nobody gives a shit about you. I'm sorry.
The highest court of our land, the Supreme Court, it makes it up as it goes along. When it suits their purpose, they'll choose a precedent and say that this is a vaunted precedent that we can't make an exception. You know, we have to apply by this. But when it doesn't suit their purpose, they will ignore that precedent. Again, Gustavus Myers, in his The History of the Supreme Court book, he writes about this. We're brought up to practically worship these Supreme Court justices, and they're fraudulent characters, just like so many of the founding lawyers were.
Founding fraudsters, yes. In fact, the U.S. Supreme that Parenti talks about calls the Supreme Court an aristocratic branch of government, as its members are appointed, serve for life, and have great power for good or ill. They're also very well paid and enjoy expensive gifts and lavish trips paid for by corporations and other affluent interests, courting influence and getting it. High court justices most always side with corporate America, and their decisions show it. Today, it's more obvious than ever, with court ideology conservative to reactionary, no liberals among them, in support of business and authoritarian government. But even well into the New Deal era in the 1930s, the Supreme Court was the activist bastion of laissez-faire capitalism that White House and public pressure finally changed by 1937 to get the court to accept New Deal legislation. Parenti explains how high courts, quote, opposed restrictions on capitalist power overall, but supported restrictions on the civil liberties of persons who agitated against that power, unquote. In the past and now, quote, the court treated the allegedly pernicious quality of a radical idea as evidence of its lethal efficacy and as justification for its suppression, unquote. So it was possible to convict communists or socialists under the Smith Act, even though they only advocated a different economic system, not the forcible overthrow of the government that would be a crime. dissenting ideas and beliefs are lawful under the First Amendment's right of free expression, but often in the past and now people exercising their constitutional right pay a stiff price, and Supreme and other courts go along. And, of course, we know that the real story of the Constitution, I don't know whether Parenti's just paying lip service to that or if he gets the whole story, you know, vis-a-vis the informer in Montgomery. And, by the way, I did look at elements of ecclesiastical law today, and there it is. Basically, the Pope is the big dog in the meat house.
But he stays well in the background.
He sure as heck does.
Oh, remember something, too, and again... the show is supposed to be archived. I mean, not that you guys care, but I mean, it's all right. I mean, I'm just mentioning it because all the stuff was brought up in 90 minutes that I had with these two gentlemen from the UK, one of whom dates back to me like 2007 and got into the Informer as I got into the Informer. You know, and we were talking about this, and I was reluctant to broach the Vatican because I never know who I'm talking to, and you need a lot of time. We all know that. I mean,
yeah.
It looks so farcical or sounds so farcical upon your ears the first time around, but if you do the research, you realize indeed, like some movie, that the one you expect least to be the perp is the one that's the perp. You know what it reminds me of? Do you remember the movie Usual Suspects with Kevin Spacey?
Yeah.
And parallel that you have with the Vatican. Nobody expects it because, oh, they're the Vatican. Ho, 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 ho. Well, guess what? That's the reason why this thing continues. And people never stop to think that, you know what? It might just be that. Let me take a look. And they don't do it.
Never will you see a major book publisher publish this stuff. There's a couple of that were on there, but that's only because the author didn't get it. Like the book Hitler's Pope by John Cornwell. It should have been The Pope's Hitler.
I think that was a good point. Theo, that's exactly how it should have gone down, at least the title, you know, because that's really how it was.
Yeah, the author can only shrug his shoulders and scratch his head so much in that book. He just, wow, why did Pope Pius XII accommodate Hitler like this and this and this? I don't get it. Gee.
But I tell you what, if you look at Cornwell's background, you realize that he's part of the problem.
Yes,
could he have gotten it and just didn't want to you know, ruff any feathers, I don't know.
He reminds me of Tupper Saucy, and who's the other one that used to be on Coast to Coast? Was it Malachi Martin?
Malachi Martin.
All right.
Father Malachi Martin.
Yeah, those two. And Phelps and them went back and forth. I mean, it was a great tennis game. But Saucy's now dead. I think Martin might be too also. And Eric Chartfield's might as well be. But at any rate, those two, and I think what Cornwell, whatever his name was, they give you enough to make them seem like they're legit, but they don't take you the whole way through. They just grab you and they stop at a certain point. And that's when everybody says, okay, so, you know, the Pope and the Vatican isn't that big a deal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And the gentleman, again, asked me about, you know, the Vatican and the whole pedophilia thing. I'm like, look, I don't know about the pedophilia thing and how systemic that is in the Roman Catholic Church because I don't care about the Roman Catholic parishioners. I'm focusing on the Vatican as a nation state. And they said, what do you think about the new Pope? I'm like, he's just a figurehead like a president. It isn't the white Pope. It's the black Pope. It's the Jesuit Superior General.
Yep.
So, I mean, they can put anybody out there they want to. Like the time when Colvin back, a long time black Pope, went to Joey Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, and asked if he could retire. Do you know how of a joke that is?
That was just a dog and pony show.
Right, exactly. Would you please let... Are you kidding me? Colvin Beck would slap Ratzinger around whenever he wanted to. So, I mean, you have to laugh at the theater, but that's what we're involved with. And that's all this whole life is just one gigantic illusion wrapped in a conundrum, wrapped in a puzzle. Oh, listen, by the way, I just got an email. Can I share this with you?
Sure.
This guy doesn't know. Of course you have to say yes, but... This guy, I've been wanting.
Your show.
I want to get a hold of him. I tried to. He moved from Jersey to Utah. Don't ask me why. But at any rate, he says, get this. Hiya, Al. Tom from Utah, formerly from New Jersey. Just catching up with these newer Olympic shows. I'm happy you're continuing your work. I wanted to add something to a point you discussed on the show with Ronald Lee Claxton concerning Washington, D.C. and the two fertility symbols being positioned in line with one another. I think of great significance is the reflecting pool sitting directly between the obelisk and the dome reflecting the heavens.
Yep.
You know where I'm going with this, all right? I believe this most certainly represents the occult principle, as above, so below. Also, at certain times of the year and certain years, the pool must reflect what are significant constellations, stars, planets, etc., with deep meaning. Hey, who knows? Could this be even more than symbolic? Could something actually be birth? Well, there you go. And I'm so glad to hear from him because I've been wanting to get in touch with him so badly. And, man, I tell you what, when I saw this just a few seconds ago, I'm a very happy guy.
So, that's some good stuff that he wrote.
He really is. And I tell you what, if there is a saving grace in me being involved with this thing for his, and I ain't complaining. I mean, nobody forced me to do this. But when people like him drop in like this across the years, not like every day, I mean, I haven't communicated with him like probably in 5 or 6 years. Bang, and there he is.
Wow.
And he comes out with stuff like that, and I'm like, that makes you understand that there are people out there who will always get it.
Yep, and that's that little word, propinquity.
You got it. It's a great word.
Now if we could hear from John Valentini.
Oh, who knows? Jeez. Are you familiar with that, Eric?
No, I'm not.
Valentini is the one that started this whole thing about predictive programming, despite what the Collins creeps talk about, and all the 9/11 symbology in movies. I mean...
Oh, that! Okay, yes. I just couldn't put the name to the face.
It's John Valentini, and I mean, we're going to try to save that stuff, by the way, as you well know, with the unfortunate demise of Angie. And we're going to try to save those websites, but he's the one that did that. It was all him. And then something happened, and I never heard of him. He lives in Australia. But he had gone to the Collins brothers with what he had because he was actually motivated by them, and they shit all over him. You know, of course, they do this when they don't think anybody's looking. And I'm like, holy mackerel, you know? But, I mean, Valentini is the person responsible for all those images and the people that also were motivated by him to see all the 9/11 stuff. And, of course, it's the old story. It's like, well, that was just, you know, coincidence. It's like, okay, well, then you show me another bunch of numbers that show up in movies like that, and note-takers.
The numerical odds have got to be so long, it's not even funny. I can't even imagine how many zeros there would be in the odds. And I have to say, that guy did some stellar spade work in coming up with all that.
Yeah, and I mean, if you go to thinkofeaton.com right now and you go to, Fiasco Photos, just look for that and click on it, and you better do it soon because that's not going to be up there all that much longer until we can finally mirror the sites. But I mean, I ran with it, but it was Valentini who found most of that stuff. And, that's another person, in fact, Eric and Theo, that I wish, just like this email I just got from Tom, would get in touch with me because there's a debt of gratitude toward him, and he's gone quite by the boards. In fact, even Alex the Great has ripped off the stuff that we have as well with regard to those images.
Oh, you're kidding.
Why am I not surprised?
Eric, what I like about the Anti-Federalists to begin with is, to use a politically correct word, the diversity of the writers. You had a number of writers. I'm sure you know how many, but of course, with the Federalists, we just had the three aristocratic lawyer or lawyering banksters. Just three. But with the Anti-Federalists, you had, a dozen or more?
Oh, gosh. There were something like, I don't know, there were 85 papers. I don't remember how many, but I like to say that they ranged from Yale to jail. And everybody in between, from all walks of life.
All walks of life, huh?
Yep, all walks of life. Instead of the, three money douchebags that wrote the Federalist Papers.
And of course,
Hamilton was such a British agent. This is one thing I have to be honest about Tarpley that really pisses me off. I think Tarpley gets it too, but I think he plays dumb. He has this almost deific worship of Hamilton. And there was somebody who talked about Hamilton being British agent number so-and-so, and Tarpley acted like somebody had just slapped his mother. And I'm thinking to myself, if this Joker's supposed to be such a great researcher, no. How come he never talks about the anti-federalists or the works of Montgomery or The Informer or any of the stuff that was going on, say, related to an hologram of liberty?
Eric,
what the hell is up with this guy?
I will tell you, above all things, that guy's still a LaRusciian.
Bingo.
Okay, so he and Anton Chaykin and that asshole Steinberg are all in this, you know, I don't even know if LaRouche is still alive, but they have this, like, love affair with Lincoln. What is the triumvirate they always talk about?
FDR.
John Quincy Adams, Lincoln, and FDR. And I'm like, yeah, and your point is what? So, listen, they're New World Order backdoor specialists. Otherwise, I can't understand why LaRouche would have chapters all over Europe. What's that about? You know, I mean, LaRouche has been trying to get elected, I guess, for I don't know how long. And Chaykin and Tarpley supposedly left the fold. He never did. He's still a LaRouchian, and that's the game they play.
His lingo reveals it.
Well, it's all about the Brits and nobody else. The Brits did it. So,
yeah.
But you see, they're all a bunch of queer idiots because they go ahead with something and then they run it into something else. And I had it out with Steinberg on a local radio show, and I challenged him to a debate. But it would have to be with time limits, because did you ever hear Steinberg or Chaykin on rents or anything? Once they start talking, they never stop.
They fetzerize.
They do.
Fetzerize. I never heard that. I like it, though.
No, they'll get on, and they'll filibuster. And I told the show host, if we'll debate, but there's going to have to be time limits, because they're not going to turn around and address something and take 35 minutes to do so. If that's, you know, if we can have time limits, I'll do the debate. And the show host punked out. He said, no. I'm like, yeah, we can kiss my ass, too. Okay? Because that's the way they work. Those guys are as big as Nazis as there is anywhere else. They're just as bad as Zionists. And they go.
Yeah, you're right about their debating. They take the ball, they run with it, and they just don't stop.
Hey, listen, the author Bill Still, you're familiar with that deal, right, with him?
Yeah, I am. Go ahead.
Are you familiar, Eric, with William Still? Wrote New World Order and the Money Masters?
I think so, about Bush.
Well, not well. That, he's the one that, well, of course, that's the famous Habba-da-habba-da-habba moment when I had him on. But the thing,
he thinks Bush is great and powerful.
Well, he says how the Federal Reserve wags all the presidents, but it'll be different with George Bush. I'm going, well, didn't you just tell me that the Fed wags them? Oh, well, no. That was at the end of the interview. But you see, that's why I don't want guests on anymore. Why would I want somebody on like that who doesn't get it? I mean, what an idiot. I'm sorry. You know, Bill Still, okay, great. You know the Fed wags everything, but you got this belief in George Bush. So in other words, if they have that, they don't get it. So why?
My hunch about Still would be that he's a CNP guy just like Monteith.
Well, I will say this, and Still told me this off mic, that he had to flee Northern Virginia where he lived. For a couple of years, he basically hid out in Florida, because when he went after LaRouche for certain things, as LaRouche got busted for, credit card fraud and some other things, he was getting death threats from the LaRouchian crowd. Okay? That's the way they play the ball game. And you can go to a site, Rick Ross. Do a search on Rick Ross plus, you know, and add LaRouche, and he's got stuff on cults you won't believe. You talk about McGowan, this guy is no second fiddle. And that's what they're about. They're a bunch of thugs. Anton Chaykin got my cell phone number and was trying to make me contribute to LaRouche's cause. Now, Chaykin doesn't know me from a hole in a wall, but they take it upon themselves to break people. He would not stop. And finally, I changed my cell phone number because the motherfucker, excuse me, would not stop. That's what they're about. They're as bad as Scientology, man.
I had a Laurentian calling me, too. I had one, a gal, I can't remember her name, was calling me and hitting me up for money until I finally had to tell her, look, I'm sorry. I don't mind talking with you, but as far as coughing up any jack, you're going to have to find another fish.
You know, I've just for kicks, I've been threading through old archives of Dave McGowan's essays, Al, and I came across one from, you know, the early 2000s, and he was writing about being accosted. He was just going to the grocery store, was McGowan, and he got accosted by a young Laurentian. It's a hilarious exchange.
That's classic.
Well, we were talking about 9/11 with Steinberg, and Steinberg says, are you kidding me? You think the government did it? I'm like, you guys are supposed to be, like, so hip. And I'm like, are you telling me you think that 19 Arabs did that? You idiot. Oh, it was the best. The old days of 1350 and 1400 WZHRAM, Dade City, New Tampa. All right, dude, you got two choices. Say goodnight right now. We've got another half an hour.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say goodnight right now, guys.
All right, you never got to unload any of the information. How did that happen?
Well, I got to unload some of it, but there is 2 weeks from now. There is two, and you know something? I'd be loaded for bear because now I got these books. I know exactly where I'm going for this, and I'll be rocking and rolling.
Well, I tell you what, it wasn't necessarily not germane, but it was a little bit different approach. In fact, the only time we ever did this was the whole series.
Well, you know what? I feel this is one of the best chats we've ever had.
Go, Eric. Otherwise, I'll...
Okay, I'll go. I was just going to say that I'm glad I didn't do a whole bunch of reading. You know, I like to do the reading, and I also like to do some you know, shit shooting, too. And I thought this was a nice balance.
All right. Eric, the blacksmith, we thank you for this particular part, and we'll pick it up in our, who knows, you know, never-ending series.
See you guys. Thanks again.
Hey, Eric.
Older than I'm younger than I. Chief Albert Turry told me that he was here just literally 10 or 15 minutes after the events that took place this morning. That is the first crash. He said that at one point he had roughly 10 alarms. That would equate to roughly 200 to 225 New York City firefighters who were in the building. This was after the crash, trying to rescue civilians who were in there. Now, earlier this morning on the Today Show, we spoke to the director of the World Trade Center. He said that at that hour of the morning, you could have upwards of 10,000 people in each of those towers. That would be 20,000 people total in each tower. The chief of safety, as the chief safety of the Fire Department of New York City, told me that shortly after 9 o'clock, he had roughly 10 alarms, roughly 200 men in the building trying to effect rescues of some of those civilians who were in there, and that basically he received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place, and then an hour after the first hit here, with the first crash that took place, he said, there was another explosion that took place in one of the towers here. So obviously, he, according to his theory, he thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. One of the secondary devices he thinks that took place after the initial impact was, he thinks, may have been on the plane that crashed into one of the towers. The second device he thinks, he speculates, was probably planted in the building. So that's what we have been told by Albert Turry, who is the chief of safety for the New York City Fire Department. He told me that just moments ago. Now, we are continuing to hear explosions. We are continuing to hear explosions here downtown. And what we've been told by some of the fire officials is that there are some gas lines that occasionally are exploding down there, because obviously, as you can imagine, there are a lot of open gas lines down in the southern part of Manhattan where the World Trade Center towers used to be. As far as the situation right here, basically what we have are hundreds of New York City firefighters and other New York City rescue units who are massed here. There is a cordon down just down there. We are not sure, to be honest, if some rescue workers have tried to go beyond that point as yet. When we spoke to the head of the Port Authority Police, that would be the organization that is in charge of the World Trade Center building itself, the Port Authority Police chief told us that they were at that point about, I'd say 40 minutes ago, about to make a decision on whether or not it was safe to send emergency workers back in there. But the bottom line is that according to the chief of safety of the New York City Fire Department, he says that he probably lost a great many men in those secondary explosions, and he said that there were literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in those two towers when the explosions took place. He said everything above the 60th floor was extremely difficult to get to, as you can imagine.
Pat Dawson.
Back to you.
Pat Dawson, thanks very much.